Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. This morning, we'll be kicking off a month-long theme focusing on women empowerment mompreneurs. Joining me this morning is my special guest, Allegra Houston, a mompreneur, author of Love Child, a memoir of family lost and found. With a professional ballerina mother, a well-known film director dad, and a British historian as a father, Allegra Houston was on the world stage from birth. Allegra was born in London, lived in Long Island, Los Angeles, Mexico, and even had a bunch of supporting cast from family members, including her father, film director John Houston, her sister, actress Angelica Houston, her biological father, British historian John Julius Norwich, and a bunch of Hollywood heavyweights, including Jack Nicholson, Ryan O'Neill, and Harry Dean Stanton. Allegra stood both in the shadows and upon the shoulders of these individuals while defining her own sense of self as she pursues her family history and her desire to find serenity. In Love Child, her memoir, published by Simon & Schuster, Allegra relates to how she crafted her life, which encompasses love, peace, her family, her son, and the opportunity to work with both woods and nature. Good morning, Allegra. Welcome back to From My Mom's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm very well, thank you, Johnny.
Great. You have lived in Taos and New Mexico, a mecca for artists, and you've created a life for yourself encompassing editing, writing screenplays, and conducting screenwriting workshops. But close to a decade, you were an editor in London. In 1995, you began working for Chatto and Windus Publishers. You were first an assistant, and then you became an editor yourself. What inspired you to get into the publishing world?
Well, I read English at Oxford. So it was always, you know, I loved reading, I loved books. It was always something that, you know, appealed to me. But really what happened is a friend of mine was Carmen Carroll's assistant, and he got promoted to be an editor, and he just passed me on his job. So it was easy.
No, that was a great, was this your first job that you did out of college?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yeah, it was my first proper job.
So how was that, you know, with regards to in terms of enthusiasm, you know, being that is the first thing that you did, and of course it's something that obviously you have worked hard for in some ways. I mean, I'm sure you aspired to be an editor somehow. So how did that kind of relate to everything else, what you were doing at that moment in your
life? Well, I did, yeah. I worked very hard. You know, publishing is not famous for how well it pays, but that didn't matter to me. So I worked all hours. I always was taking work home at weekends, and I was often at my desk until 10 or 11 o'clock at night. But I really enjoyed what I did. It was what I wanted to be doing.
You were, I mean, it's something that, you know, you were drawn. You were taking English, obviously, as a major. Was there anything else that you were looking at in terms of doing if that was not the case, so to speak?
Not really. I wasn't one of those people that grew up with an idea of, you know, what I always wanted. I always knew what I wanted to be. I never knew what I wanted to be. So, you know, that kind of opportunity opened itself up to me, and I just went with it. I always envied people who really knew what they wanted to be from an early age, but it wasn't me.
How about your friends? I mean, how did they take it in terms of, like, wow, you know, you sort of got shooed into where you wanted to do, or certainly you aspired to be, and comparatively to them, how did they take all this?
Well, it was the mid-80s, so most of them were getting similar, you know, things were booming in London then, and so most people were able to get the job they wanted.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
In 1987, you moved, obviously, to a different company, and you were editorial director from 90 to 94, and in the course of during that time, you've worked with so many great authors. What are some of the works that you were very proud of and that stood above others?
I would say working with Jane Goodall was probably the highlight of it all. I'm sure everybody knows her name. She is a great student of chimpanzees and chimpanzee behavior, and it was she who actually exploded the old definition of what a human is, as someone who makes and uses tools, because she realized that when she was watching the wild chimpanzees in Tanzania fishing for termites, that they were making and using termite fishing tools. They would, you know, find the appropriate branch and shape it and twist it and so on. So she not only gave us an enormous amount of knowledge about chimpanzees, but also about human beings. Mm-hmm. She's also just the most wonderful, wonderful woman. I think I was luckiest of all to work with her. I was also very lucky to work with Robert Conquest, who was the great Sovietologist. I mean, he was the most highly respected of all, and he was the first one to actually research and write about some of the atrocities that Stalin had been committing in the 30s before the Second World War. The gulags, the famine, the purges, and I was his editor on what was basically the kind of culminating work of his career, which was his biography of Stalin, which was called Stalin, Creator and Destroyer. So that was another really amazing honor to be able to work with Bob, and my job as an editor in both those cases was to help the author, and every other was to help the author make their book as good as it could possibly be.
You also had a chance to travel all over the world too. Now, were you doing this during the time that you were working with Jane, or is this something that you were doing it on your own? Because I was just
doing it on my own in the holidays. I always wanted to go to Tanzania and visit Jane there and see Gombe, the place where the park where she followed the chimpanzees. But I still haven't been there.
I see. What are some of the memorable places that you've been?
Well, I've traveled all over Mexico to all the pre-Columbian sites in Mexico, all the major ones and most of the minor ones, too. And I love those, and I'm fascinated by that history and culture. Angkor Wat is definitely one of my favorite places I've ever been, Cambodia. Turkey, Jordan. Jordan was fantastic. India. Both the South and Rajasthan, Sri Lanka. I had a fantastic, fascinating couple of weeks in Sri Lanka.
Now, you were also writing for a travel magazine, correct?
Well, the first, it started because I knew the travel editor of a magazine in England called The Tatler, and he used to call me up and ask me if any of my authors would be interested in doing this journey or that and writing about it. And one day he called me up and said, did I have an author who, it was midwinter, who wanted to go sometime in the next month and take the travel by train from Beijing to London. And I said, well, how about me? I had 2 weeks of holiday that I had to take, you know, within the next 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'd never written anything before. But he kind of, you know, paused for a moment and gulped a bit and said, well, okay. So that was what started my travel writing. It was a kind of strange experience because I got on the train in Beijing at 7 a.m. Beijing time on, I think it was the 15th of January, 1991, which was the day that the first Gulf War started at 7 a.m. Kuwait time.
Right.
So I got on the train basically 2.5 hours, which was the time difference, before the Gulf War started. And so, you know, that kind of joke of where do you want to be when the next world war breaks out, Outer Mongolia. That's where I was. I just saw the Great Wall. I was in Outer Mongolia.
That's very interesting. I mean, I'm sure it's quite fascinating that you're having the opportunity to travel. And, you know, they always say train traveling is something which is very unique because you have a chance to see the countryside.
I love trains.
Lives and lives, yeah. What other trains have you taken? I knew, for me, I enjoyed taking the train from Paris to Marseille in France because it was just something unique and different, again, being able to see the countryside and the people as a whole rather than flying from airport to airport.
Right. Yeah, well, the longest train journey I've taken by far was that one from Beijing to London. You know, that was it was Beijing to Moscow and then Moscow to Berlin and then Berlin to London. But, you know, obviously I've taken the train all around England and Ireland. I've taken the train from here in Taos, where I live, to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken the train from Cairo to Luxor. I've taken quite a number of trains in India.
How are they compared to the ones in U.S.? Because I know...
Lousy! European trains are the best trains. American trains suck. They're really slow. They break down. They're not comfortable. The food's dreadful.
Right. But at the same time, though, you know, like in the U.S., we fly so much that our airports are fully developed.
That's exactly what's common.
Right, and then when you go to Europe or in Asia, I presume where you have people travel by rail, then that aspects of the public transportation or mass transportation in this case, they're fully developed from being fairly organized.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it's sort of a different comparison, so to speak, I guess.
It's not meant as a cultural criticism. It's just an observation of fact.
Yeah. Oh no, no, I agree. You know, I've traveled on those trains before, so I understand where you're coming from. What have you learned, both personally and professionally, from someone like Jane Goodall? I mean, who obviously had made an impression on you while you were working with her, editing her book and everything else. What are some of the wonderful things that you have taken in personally as well as professionally?
Well, the thing that I admire about her more than anything, and I admire her for almost more than anybody else that I've ever met, is that she is very sure in herself what's important and what isn't. Mm-hmm. And she wastes absolutely no energy on what isn't important. She doesn't get distracted. There's nothing trivial about anything that she does, thinks, says. She's completely focused, but not ruthless at all. You know, there's nothing unpleasant about it. There's nothing sort of strident or rough about her. She's incredibly sweet and softly spoken and gentle by nature, but she wastes no energy on what isn't important. And I find that, it's so easy to get distracted by, petty things or, little upsets or, other people's problems. And I just so admire that in her, that ability to stay focused on what's important to her and use all of her energy for that cause.
That was what I learned from her.
Absolutely. She's devoted her whole life to it.
Precisely, about a passion about doing something. And I know we have talked about this prior to you coming on the air this morning about how if we put passion in work, and I've kid with you, well, I wouldn't say a kid, but that's how I view work sometimes, where a career to me is where you put a lot of passion in it, and a career is a hobby that you do and you get paid for it, as compared to, say, a work that you do, to pay bills and everything else. And in life, sometimes one could have several careers because it depends on how passionate one is about that particular moment in their life doing certain things.
Right, exactly.
So do you feel like in the course of doing what you have done so far, and I've no, we have not covered everything that you've done, but certainly up to that point in your life that you were obviously very passionate about, being the editor and everything else and having the opportunity to work with these various people. How was your state of mind at that time being young and being given the opportunity to do so?
Well, it was fantastic. I was very excited about it, and I was very, very into it. I mean, I have had a number of careers, and that one kind of, ended. I left publishing on my 30th birthday because I realized that I was a very good editor, and I still am. I do a lot of freelance editing. I'm a good editor, but I wasn't particularly a good publisher in that I wasn't good at the office politics and the networking and all of that kind of stuff. And the more I got promoted, the less editing I did and the more of that kind of stuff I was, expected to do. So I found myself, doing things that I wasn't particularly good at and didn't particularly like, as opposed to doing things that I actually was good at and did like, but were kind of considered to be somehow less valuable, which, I disagree, but there you have it. So I got a bit frustrated with that, and I left publishing. I continued to do freelance editing. And then I started working for a film distribution and production company, looking for projects for them both to distribute and to put money into production of. And I did that for a couple of years. And that kind of got a little bit frustrating also. And eventually I just sort of realized that I didn't want to be only working on other people's projects. I wanted to be working on my own as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the nature of being an editor is that nobody really knows what you do except you and the author. And there aren't that many authors who will come out and say, well, my book was a real mess until my editor sorted it out for me. You know? So it tends to be a very sort of secret kind of activity. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, I started, after I'd been working in the film business, I was also frustrated by just how bad were so many of the scripts that were getting made. And I thought, well, surely I can do better. And so I sat down and tried and wrote a script with a friend. And actually, it wasn't very good. I didn't realize that at the time. I know it now. It's a lot harder than it looks, Wow, big surprise. But that got me into, wanting to write and tell my own stories. And eventually that ended up with me writing my book, which is called Love Child, and it's a memoir.
Right. Coming back to the writing screenplays, what is the major difference, I guess, between screenplays and versus writing a book?
Well, the major difference is once you write a book, you've written it, and as long as you've got a publisher for it, it's going to be published, and that's the end of the story. Mm-hmm. And it's the book that you wrote. A screenplay is the blueprint for a movie, of which the director is really the person who's, the author of it. And there's so many other things that, are part of why it gets made and why it doesn't. And much of that is nothing to do with the quality of the story or the quality of the writing, but it's to do with money and scheduling and who wants to keep their job and who owes who a favor and, just all kinds of considerations that are really nothing to do with the work that you've done as a writer. So it can be a very frustrating profession.
You've kind of gone back.
I still do it. I still write screenplays, but
right.
It definitely has been good for me to write a book and actually finish it and see it published.
What were some of the memorable screenplays that you've worked on?
Well, I haven't. None of my screenplays have actually been made into films. Mm-hmm. So, all of my screenplays are memorable to me,
mm-hmm.
But none of them are as yet memorable to anybody else.
I understand. How about the most recent one, I guess, you've worked on is World's End.
Yeah. Well, I just finished a rewrite on it. It's a true story. Another one of my kind of problems as a screenwriter is that I write screenplays for movies that I want to see, mm-hmm. which tend to be, not about car chases and shoot 'em up and drug dealers, but they're often historical. They're stories that I find fascinating. They also tend to be expensive to make, so they're not naturally little independent films that I would have a better chance of getting made. World's End is set in the New Spain, a time just after the Spanish conquest of Mexico, and we just finished a rewrite on it about a week or two ago. So, I'm about to send it back out to a producer who I know is interested in it and, hoping for the best, expecting the worst, as usual.
It sounds like a wonderful piece. I mean, it's. I think in today's world, I mean, sometimes we need stories, human interest stories.
Well, I think we do. I think we're actually all tired of all this, comic book stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's been done to death now. It's over,
right.
It's been done. And I think it's time that we have movies to go to that are real stories,
right.
That do show real people in real situations, at extremes. I think, movies are often about, good movies are often about people at extremes of experience.
Right.
And that's, those are the stories that I write and hope one day to get made.
Do you gravitate towards real life, real situation? Are you someone
I do.
Focused to some?
Yeah, I do, both in movies and in books, yeah.
And you also contributed to wowohwow.com, a website for women.
Yeah.
And there's some very interesting women that actually are on the website. And tell us a little bit about that and how it has empowered you and you know, in being able to have the opportunity to work with these women.
Well, it stands for Women on the Web, W-O-W. And it was founded by a very formidable, impressive group of women, fronted by, the editor of it is called Joni Evans. She used to be editor-in-chief at Random House. But Whoopi Goldberg is part of it, Peggy Noonan, Candace Bergen, Leslie Stahl, Joan Juliet Buck, who used to be the editor of French Folk, and, you know, a number of other very impressive women. So it's really, it's like, you know, it's a sort of magazine online that has news and features and, you know, financial page advice and also, you know, features about, you know, life. And they have there's a slot in the website called A Friend Stop By. And I've written three pieces for that slot now. I'm a friend of Wow Oh Wow. It's been great. You know, it's not you don't get paid for writing for them.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, nobody's yet quite figured out how to make the web pay, because it started off as free, and that's one of the, you know, the newspapers are all folding because they are actually paying their journalists.
Right.
And people are getting their news from, you know, from the web online for free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a major problem for quality journalism, obviously, because who's going to be doing it if the newspapers aren't paying and the web hasn't figured out how to charge for it? But, you know, I'm not spending a lot of, you know, I'm not spending weeks or months researching a story when I write for Wow Oh Wow. I'm just writing something that interests me, that, you know, is part of my life. So I don't need to get paid for it. And there's a very big audience. It has, I think, 400,000 people looking at it every day. So it's very nice for me to be able to write something and have that audience and have the interactive quality of it, because, of course, they have a space at the bottom where people can make comments, post comments on the articles. So that's, you know, I enjoy getting that feedback on whether people have enjoyed what I've written, if it's, you know, if they've responded to it.
So do you actually get feedbacks from, the number of people that have actually read your article? I mean, being that, you know, they get 400,000.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wrote an article about Adam Lambert, and it's had over 1,000 comments on it so far.
Oh, my God. So, I mean, I can see why now they don't pay anyone. But it is an interesting website, because I've been to it, and it's quite fascinating, all these powerful women kind of got together and they are involved with it in some
way. Yeah, well, the nice thing, they have a quite interesting idea, which is often they'll just take a question, some sort of topical question of the day, and they'll ask the women who front the website, you know, what their response is to that question. So mm-hmm. as well as just having, you know, your basic news and features and everything else, you get you know, a very interesting take on how these women are responding to, you know, various questions.
No, it's interesting. It's very, very interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about your new endeavor, which is writing from the imaginative storm. Quite a very interesting, catchy phrase here, and I know it's something that's very passionate to you. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's something that I've been doing for about 5 years with my partner in this enterprise. His name is James Nave, who's a performance poet, a slam poet. We used to call it the Writing Salon, but we always had this kind of subtitle, I guess, of Writing from the Imaginative Storm, and we decided we're just going to use that now. And it's a writer's workshop retreat, basically, for writers at all levels, anyone who needs to write anything, basically. And we meet in Taos, New Mexico, and also in certain other places. The last 2 years, we've also done one in Black Mountain, North Carolina, in May. Taos is going to be this August 2nd to the 7th, so, you know, just under a month from now. You can go to thewritingsalon.net for more information, or also to my website, which is allegrahouston.com, allegrahouston.com. And we basically spend 5 days doing what I call disposable writing, because I think one of the problems that most people have, and certainly the main problem that I had as a writer, is I thought that everything I wrote was supposed to be good. And when you start off writing like that, it freaks you out, and it slows you down, and it ties you up in knots, and the results are not good. So I think that the practice of not caring whether what you write is good, because we do a lot of writing something in 10 minutes, and of course if you write something in 10 minutes, how can it possibly be any good, right? So it kind of removes that whole question. But because once you remove the question, of course, much of what you write actually is quite good because it has energy in it, and excitement and interest, and you end up really surprising yourself. So we do a lot of that. We do a lot of sort of improvisational exercises. We do like acting exercises, things like that. We go out for hikes. We, improv rooms. We do, all kinds of stuff like that. And the goal of the whole thing really is just to kind of like, open up all those shut places in the imagination that then feed energy and freshness and interest and excitement into what you're writing, whether it's nonfiction, fiction, poetry, screenplays, whatever. It's very much a cross-disciplinary thing. So what we're not doing is critiquing anyone's serious work. What we are doing is helping people find a way to access the most interesting and exciting and original parts of their own imaginations. And I feel like I'm really the poster child for this. I don't think I could have written my book. I'm serious. I don't think I could have written my book if it wasn't for, having done 5 years of this. It was 3 years when I started writing it. But, I was very tangled up in, the thought of having to write something good. And the result was that I didn't write anything at all. It's a very freeing, inspiring, and wonderful way of going about teaching writing. But I don't know that I haven't come across anybody else who's doing it exactly in that way as we are. And I seriously believe this is the way that creative writing should be taught, not in the kind of workshop settings that you usually get on creative writing courses. I highly disapprove and disagree with the idea of criticism of somebody's serious work being a spectator sport. I just don't think that helps. Mm-hmm. So we come at things from a very different kind of perspective.
Sure. Well, I agree with that because I agree with you in terms of every path has its own end. And so really,
yeah.
When you start critiquing it, then you are imposing your sense of what the ending or the visual side, what you thinking what it is to be for the other person.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so this is very, very different. Well, do you have any is this open to everyone? Is this something that?
Yes, it's open to anyone who gets in touch with us and signs up. Absolutely.
Someone who could be a novice could sign up and just. Trying to get the writing experience.
Yeah, we have a lot of people who haven't written anything that they would describe as serious. Everybody has written something. We all write, every day.
Right.
Probably, we write emails, we write all kinds of things. If we're working in offices, we write presentations and memos and all kinds of stuff. And it's actually very important to get energy into those things too. The job of those things is to inspire somebody else to do something the way you want them to do it. So, it makes a giant difference whether you have this sort of energy and excitement and enthusiasm in that writing. We get a lot of people who are, quite high-level professional people who are wanting to write something creative. So we get a lot of lawyers, and lawyers do
really?
Enormous amount of writing. We get a lot of lawyers who want to write novels, detective novels or something. We had a cartoonist one time who was working on a novel. We had a constitutional historian who was working on a memoir. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who, are experienced in many ways but don't quite know how to make it, or don't feel like they know how to take it into a more creative and less prosaic, or I don't know what the word would be, but just to take it into a more creative kind of direction.
That's
more
very interesting. What is the most common, I wouldn't say complaint, but the things that this writers come in and express to you guys on the opening day, that what are they looking for, what is the common denominator that all these individuals have in terms of the ability to write?
I would say what most people are really looking for is just what I said. I mean, what I think we give people that they're really hungry for is the sense of the freedom of their imagination, that every word they write doesn't have to be good, isn't supposed to be good, and actually doesn't help them if it is. Because if you're so worried about everything being good, then you don't take any risks and you don't surprise yourself, and what you write is kind of, you know, a bit dead on the page. The freedom that we give people to just sort of explore and not have to be quote unquote good,
mm-hmm.
Just to be interesting and interested to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That is really the thing that most people have maybe not even consciously known they were lacking, but that they've definitely found us because they've been in search of it.
So the take-home value basically is overcoming the fear of your work not being good enough, or do I perfection that is right off the gate, basically?
Yeah, largely. Yeah, it's certainly a large part of the value of it. Yeah, of what you take home. You take home more than that as well. You take home some very specific stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the transformative part. You know,
right.
That's the thing that really changes people's lives and certainly changes people's creative lives.
Very interesting. Let's talk about your book, Love Child. You shared a lot of definitive moments in your life in the early years. You mentioned when you were a teen, the marriage between John Houston and his second wife, CC.
Actually, his fifth wife.
I'm sorry, fifth wife. Oh.
Yes. My mother was the fourth.
My correction on that, and who you were living with, ended, and in her eyes, he abandoned you, and John Julius Norwich, who is your biological father, didn't really bring you into his family, and so you began spending time with your sister Angelica, and much to Cece's concern. So how did you define the roles of these women played in your life during that time?
Well, I don't think I could define them. I don't think it really helps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people do what they do. In my case, everybody did the best they could in very difficult circumstances. And, you know, some of it worked well and some of it didn't work quite so well. You know, Cece was being as good a mother to me, a stepmother to me, as she possibly could. Angelica was doing her best also to be a sister to me and also to be a mother to me, to take the place of our mother who died when I was four and Angela was 17. But, you know, she was going through a tough time in her life then. She was sort of ping-ponging, rather, between Jack Nicholson and Ryan O'Neill. And I lived with both of them at different times,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, because I was with Angelica. Cece disapproved of me being brought into Ryan O'Neill's world, particularly because he took a lot of drugs.
Right.
And so, you know, it ended up in a big argument between them about what was a suitable place for me and who should look after me. But
right.
Cece, by that time, had no, you know, she had no legal control over me.
Right.
She was my, by then, ex-stepmother. You know, she lost.
Now, as a mother, how do you feel about the roles they took on in terms of, I know you mentioned about the fact that back then, obviously, you were, I guess you were going through a seesaw situation here. You have a sister who's trying to take care of you and the best way she knows how. Now, looking back as a mother now and looking back then, how do you feel?
Well, you know, they both tried to do the best they could at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, wouldn't want my son to go through some of the stuff that I went through around that time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not that it's anybody's fault, and I don't think anybody behaved
right.
badly at all. It was just, you know, very, very difficult. So, you know, really the main thing is, I guess, as far as being a mother myself now, is yes, I don't want my son to have to go through what I went through, the instability, the uncertainty about where he's going to live, who's going to look after him, who his family is. So I'm doing my best to give him the most stable life I know how to give him.
No, you did a great job about staying away from all the destructive behaviors. Obviously, you mentioned about Ryan O'Neill's group, that were involved with drugs and everything else, and somehow you were focused on obviously being, you know, more on the straight side. Who influenced you in that?
Nobody, I don't think. You know, I just knew kind of, I had this sense that if I didn't look after myself, I wasn't totally sure I could rely on anybody else to do it. So I better, you know, I better stay sane and sober and aware and alert and look after myself.
How old were you at that time?
I was absolutely terrified at the thought of taking drugs. The idea of, you know, not being in control of my own mind.
Right.
You know, that was the only thing I had to rely on. So the last thing I wanted to do was, you know, take it out of working order.
I understand. How old were you at that time while you were going?
I was 13. The year that I lived with Angelica and Ryan, I was 13.
Right. So, I mean, at that age, I mean, for a lot of, you know, children these days, I mean, they are still, I mean, you were very mature for your age. Because you were able
Yeah,
to
I was. I always was. You know, my as I say, my mother died when I was 4, and I think so. Mm-hmm. The maturity for my age probably started then, if not before.
Mm-hmm.
And I've lived on my own since I was 15. You know, so basically as soon as I finished high school, as soon as I could live on my own, I did, because then it then the question of where I was going to live and who with and who was going to look after me, you know, was answered, because then I would just do it.
Well, we are some total of a collection of what we were before today, and so and what we do today obviously will be who we're going to be, say, tomorrow and the next day and the next day. So obviously the things that you've encountered, and you mentioned a lot of things in Love Child, one of the things you talk about that you were working in a skating ring, tell us a little bit about that and how that influenced your life.
Well, that was this wonderful woman called Helena Kalyanotis, who's an actress, and lived in L.A., lived next door to Jack Nicholson. So I'd known her since I was, you know, 9 or 10, since I first went up to that house. And she was kind of like, she was more like his mother than anyone. She just basically kind of looked after his life and was there as a sort of, you know, steady emotional backstop for him and for a number of people. And she doesn't have any children of her own, but she's kind of a mother to the lost children of Hollywood. Anyway. I was going through a particularly difficult time when I was about 14, and she had just had a birthday party in L.A. I was in London at the time, so I wasn't at that first party. But she had been a roller skating champion in Boston when she was a teenager, and she decided she was going to have a birthday party at a roller rink. And a lot of her friends were, you know, well-known actors and musicians and so on. And she told everybody, you know, to meet her at the roller rink for her birthday party. And there was a certain amount of resistance, so she ended up saying, well, just meet me at, you know, the corner of this street and that street and bring socks. And people had just a really fantastic time, and they said, oh, you know, you've got to do it again, you've got to do it again. And it turned into an every Monday night club called Skateaway. And that was the beginning of the big roller disco craze of the late 70s, early 80s. Helena personally started it. Mm-hmm. And I had just come back from London to L.A. and was at very much of a sort of emotional loose end and living in a very depressing, dispiriting house. And basically she, you know, let me be her secretary and let me help her run it. So I would spend every weekend at her house, and every Monday night I'd be, you know, out skating, and then we'd go off to a nightclub and I'd be dancing until 2 in the morning, and then, you know, get up for school the next day, Catholic school, in my little uniform, which anybody else I'm sure would have considered extremely unsuitable.
Yeah.
And I know that my step-grandmother, who I was living with, definitely did consider it unsuitable, but she didn't. Mm-hmm. She wasn't really able to do anything about it. But in fact, it was what kept me sane, because it was the only thing that gave me any kind of life. And Helena was my rock at that time,
mm-hmm.
Very much. She was the one who kind of, you know, gave me a just any. She gave me a great sense of stability and strength.
But you see, what's interesting is that what I gather, too, is that stability comes from whatever you want it out to be, because it don't have to be very structured. In other words, it can be very fluid.
It can be very fluid, but it's a sort of moral stability, really. I mean, you want to be around somebody that you have a sense of, they know what's the right thing to do. They know what's right and what's wrong in any given circumstance. And Helena is very much that kind of person.
Right.
So I felt, you know, I felt like I really had somebody that I could rely on and turn to, hanging out with her.
Right. And obviously, hanging out, you guys were exposed to people from all walks of life, because
yeah,
it's not
absolutely
localized to,
and,
you know, to a specific group of people here.
Yeah, and that was the great thing about Helena too, is she made it a very inclusive place. So there were lots of, you know, movie stars and rock stars and stuff. You know, Cher used to come, and the Glenn Frey and Don Henley of the Eagles, and you know, all kinds of people. Jack used to come all the time, and quite, you know, lots of well-known actors. Jim Brown, the football player. But you know, there were also, there was a large contingent of just good, you know, serious like roller skaters. And they were, you know, just as interesting and just as much a part of the kind of gang as anybody. And my friend Miguel, that I'm still in touch with, you know, is a teacher from Detroit who moved to LA, and he was the one who actually really taught me to skate.
Very interesting. Well, how does all these characters, I mean, all these people, this broad spectrum, so to speak, of people that you've encountered during that time, affect you? I mean, you know, looking back in time, like, you know, sometimes I know we all take time to reflect back and say, you know, what happened to me at this time in my life really helped me now. I didn't see it then, but based on what I encountered back then, it certainly gave me the strength or whatever, or the insights that I needed now. Any particular thing that sort of stood up for you?
Well, I would say definitely that sense that, you know, everybody is interesting, that that it's, you know, that openness to people from all different walks of life and all different backgrounds. That was something that I think I did take from Helena, and that I'm very, very grateful for. Because my friends are a pretty pretty diverse crowd. And that sense of, I don't know what, sense of that if you have a strong kind of moral foundation yourself, if you know what you really, what you feel is good and not good, that you can be in any situation which can have all kinds of sort of, you know, quote unquote dangers in it or uncertainties. But if you have that moral compass yourself, then you'll be fine. And I was, you know, there I was in, you know, all kinds of situations that, you know, a lot of people that I knew were, you know, going very badly wrong.
Right.
But I didn't. And and I do think that Helena is largely to, you know, to be credited for that, that she taught me that.
But this was interesting, too, because you have obviously had a chance to flavor everything. But then the fact that you have the foundation of knowing what's right and what's wrong, you stood by your guns, basically. I'm sure you were people have tempted you in many ways and so forth, but you were able to say, well, no, this is not me, so I am who I am, and I'm going to continue to be who I am. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, that kind of makes it sound a bit easier than it is. But
right.
But it does help to have that kind of foundation, yeah.
Right. Traditionally, people go to college to broaden their horizon, and you had the opportunity to attend.
I went to college to narrow mine.
So, but you were in Oxford. So, how has that, in fact, impacted your life?
I don't know that it has very much, to be honest. What it did, though, was, you know, it took me to London. I mean, as soon as I finished high school and I wanted to leave L.A., I went to the other place where I had family, which was London. And the result of that was that I actually then had the opportunity to become a part of my English family, my biological father's family, my brother and sister there. So that has, you know, impacted my life hugely, because I do now have all of that family as part of my family, which, you know, I didn't before I moved there then and went to Oxford.
How was
I'm
the
very close to them.
Culture shock, I guess, from that standpoint, being in living, like you say, in LA, and then now you're going to the sort of a fairly structured, I would say.
No, Oxford isn't structured at all.
Well, not
Oxford,
but perhaps maybe the. But perhaps your English family, I guess, from that standpoint.
No, they're not. They're not
okay.
Very structured. I mean,
okay.
no more than any of the rest of my family. No, No, they're not formal.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that, but of course, you know, I had spent time in London before that, so it wasn't
mm-hmm.
completely like a culture shock to me. I'd lived there for 6 months when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I actually felt more comfortable there than I felt in L.A. You know, L.A. was not my place. These were not my people. I didn't fit in there. I fit in much better in England at that time.
Yeah. Do you feel that the fact that you have met all the different diverse people in your life and being that you've gone through so many things in your life that it makes you very adaptable at this day and age?
Yes. Yes, I am. I'm very adaptable. Definitely. I'm
because,
a chameleon,
yeah,
which isn't always the good thing, but I, you know, it has its good elements to it, which is that you can get on with all kinds of different people and fit into quite a number of different kinds of situations. And that can be a very useful skill to have.
That's true, because we are living, after all, right now, the world is such a small place. I mean, where you can be on the other side of the globe in within hours. And so, I mean, looking at your track record of what you've done and the amount of travel you've done certainly gives you a heads up versus someone else who have not done that much traveling and experience. And
I think so. I'm very glad for it.
Mm-hmm. And not only traveling, I think, and then meeting diverse people too.
Yeah, I think that's more to it than the traveling, actually, because a lot of people travel and really never leave their own little shells.
Right.
But because I lived in so many different people's households when I was a kid and they were so different,
mm-hmm.
That was really, I think, what gave me that chameleon ability more than specifically traveling.
Now, what role did writing and publishing Love Child play in helping you in sharing your empowerment message to others?
Well, I do look upon the book kind of as propaganda, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's the story of it is basically of a little girl whose world and family is shattered when I was four, when my mother was killed. And it's the story of, you know, finding all the pieces of that shattering and putting them back together in some kind of shape that resembles a family. And in my case, that, you know, the climax of that story happened when my son was christened in the Rio Grande in 2003, and all of my family were there, my brothers and sisters from both sides, from both fathers, and also my father, my biological father, John Julius, who's still alive. My dad, John Houston, was dead by then. And so that was really, you know, that was what I'd kind of always longed for, that moment at which all my family came together. So it was when I realized that, you know, that moment had happened that I decided that I wanted to write the book. And I see the book as, you know, propaganda for that vision of family, for, you know, rising above the chains of DNA and the, you know, who was married to who at the time and all the various resentments and secrets that, that you know, that happen in families.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just, you know, rising above that, accepting the family you have, embracing it, loving it, you know, kind of taking that as your family and not,
mm-hmm.
You know, not playing resentments and not playing the petty stuff.
Right.
Going back into, you know, why I admire Jane Goodall so much.
Right.
So that is the message that I want to share with my book. That's why I wrote it. I didn't write it for myself. I really did write it because I hoped that my story would resonate with people, not because it's got movie stars in it, but because it's got, you know, a broken family, the confusion, uncertainty, you know, family secrets that we've actually somehow, maybe not completely intentionally, but, you know, it's worked. We've overcome it.
Right.
And if we can overcome these kind of, you know, family dynamics and build a family that is held together by very strong bonds of love, then, you know, so can a lot of other families who are struggling with the same kind of issues. So that's why I wrote the book. It wasn't necessarily cathartic for me. I didn't write it from a kind of psychological catharsis point of view, but it has been kind of integrative. You know, it sort of feels like, yeah, now I really do have the shape of that story. story, which is the story of my life. I know kind of what it means. It has a real meaning for me, and I hope, and well, I know that it has from some of the people who've written to me, a meaning that's useful and helpful to other people.
Right. Well, I mean, it talks about basically the underlying factor is unconditional love. And
yeah,
we talked about blended
exactly.
family. And
yeah.
Statistically, people may not realize this, but by 2010, which is next year, there will be more blended family in the United States than there will be regular family.
Really? I didn't know
yeah.
that statistic.
Yeah.
How
I mean,
interesting.
It's fascinating. Yeah, it's
yeah.
fascinating.
I'm not surprised in the least.
Right. So I think, and what actually ties everything together is unconditional love, the ability
yeah,
to
exactly.
just look beyond all the differences and focus on what's good.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And
just,
and,
you know, just accept people for who they are
precisely.
And you know, and love them.
Right.
You know,
and
take the love that they can give to you and return it 10 times.
Right. And you know, in order to be loved, you got to be lovable.
That's right. Yeah.
And so it's quite fascinating because that's what my book was based about, on unconditional love. But let's talk about how you wrote Love Child. I mean, you wrote it in two coffee shops.
Yeah, mainly. Much
you know,
easier to concentrate in a coffee shop.
You chose a public place rather than the relatively quiet of a home or a regular office. I mean, is there any particular reason for doing that?
Well, if I was at home, there kind of wasn't enough distraction. So if I was getting stuck, I would get up and have a really big distraction, like, you know, do the dishes
mm-hmm.
or something.
Mm-hmm.
And a coffee shop provided me just the right amount of distraction. you know, the noise of the coffee maker
right.
and, you know,
right.
whatever music was playing and so on. But you have to choose your coffee shop. You know, it can't be one that's like a real hangout, really
mm-hmm.
chatty, loud, full of conversation, lots of people you know coming in and out. That
right.
wouldn't have worked. The first one that I chose has a kind of library atmosphere. It's full of people sitting alone with their computers.
Right.
So there's a little bit of distraction in the, you know, the sounds of the coffee maker and the music, but there's, and you know, occasionally somebody will come in that I know and just, you know, hi, but because there's
right.
this very sort of library vibe, it doesn't become a kind of chatty thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that works very, and it's a really beautiful place with a beautiful garden and comfortable sofas and, you know, little kind of, it's like a rabbit warren, all of these different rooms. So it was really nice. And then the other one was also a video rental shop, but they had a kind of back room where they would show movies in the evenings, and very few people went into that back room. So again, I would sit in there, and I would hear the music and the coffee machine and stuff from the other room, but a lot of people didn't even know I was there.
Well, I mean, if it inspires you, it gives you the creativity that you need, and certainly it works because I
yeah,
know
it worked for me.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, there's always a part of my brain that wants to be distracted. And so I have to give it something to make it shut up.
I mean, I know when I write,
you know,
let the rest
of my mind get on with it.
Right. I mean, you know, and everybody has different takes on it because I know for me, there are times that I do want to have some peace and quiet. And there are times that I knew I wrote a couple of my chapters in Starbucks.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But it is in Barnes & Noble, though, which is, like you say, it's not as, say, too busy to a point where it's just chaotic, but it's
right.
You have background noise.
Yeah, exactly. It just gives you enough background to,
right.
you know.
Well, looking back, you know, in defining success, because we talked about the topic of being mompreneurs, and you being certainly a mompreneur yourself, defining success 10 years ago compared to how you define success today, how do you compare those? When you look at it, you know, from going back in time and walking through.
Yeah,
that's
a good question. Well, 10 years ago, I definitely would have defined it in terms of the career, you know, the job that I was doing, the career path that I was on. Now, I would very definitely not define it that way. I would define it as being able to live the life that I want to live and support myself, you know, just
mm-hmm.
enough to be able to do that. Part of that is living in Taos. Basically, most of us who live here are just sort of like trying to find ways to earn
mm-hmm.
just about enough money to keep ourselves afloat and carry on living here and not have to move. So that really is how I define success now, is, you know, being able to live this you know, life of wonderful, you know, quality that I have here. And, you know, being able to, you know, to find ways to support that. So, you know, writing is one of those ways. As I say, I do a lot of freelance editing. I do teaching. I do, I help my husband run his rafting, whitewater rafting company. You know, I do all kinds of different things. And but I don't think that there's a kind of, you know, what the world would consider a successful career. That's not, that's definitely not my benchmark of success.
How does motherhood play into it?
Well, you know, because I have a son, obviously, the when I talk about the quality of life, you know, it's the quality of a life I want for all of us. So, you know, to give him that stability, to give him a place where he can, you know, grow up and be outside and, you know, learn the, you know, how wonderful it is to, you know, be in nature, to learn, you know, good values, to not think that, you know, money and possessions are the most important thing of all. And but most importantly, as I say, to, you know, to give him that stability. He knows where his home is. He knows who his family is. He knows, you know, where he belongs. And that's what I never had. So it's very, very important to me to give him that.
And what motherly experience have you tapped on based on the life that you've lived and experienced?
Well, different people mothered me in different ways. You know, Cece, my stepmother, Helena, my sister Angelica, my Irish nanny, who I used to call nurse. So, you know, I think we all make it up as we go along as parents, don't we? You just, you know, do whatever you can on what you know.
Very true.
And hope for the best.
That's right. Very, very true. Any future works besides Love Child? I know that you you're traveling, you're speaking at different places.
Yeah, I'll start working on another book soon, but I'm procrastinating right now.
but apart from just, you know, going out to signing books now, I mean, you do some clinics out there in terms of writing.
Well, we have the next Imaginative Storm workshop coming up in just under a month. I'm on my way to England this Friday. I'm teaching at a place called the Arvon Foundation, which is a residential writers workshop, and I'm reading at the Port Elliot Literary Festival in Cornwall. So that's, you know, that's the immediate future.
Now, I do have to let you know that when you read for us in Plano, Texas, it was just beautiful. I mean,
thank you.
Some people are gifted, you know. And
well, the thing is, I really like doing it. There are a lot of authors who are, you know, who don't like being in front of people, who don't like performing, and don't look upon a bookshop or, you know, a reading as a performance.
Right.
You know, they look upon it as they sort of stand up there and read out of the book.
Right.
But I think if you're going to be good at it, you have to look on it as a performance, and that's what you're doing, and that's, you know, you honor your audience by, you know,
right,
giving them that heightened amount of energy. And I do actually really enjoy it. So it's nice that you thought I was good at it.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I think, and you read obviously with passion, and but the most important thing is that you added life to it.
Reading. Yeah, exactly. And many authors think that all they're supposed to do is read.
That's correct.
But you don't. You know, you need to put the passion with which you wrote the words back into the conveying of them.
But you did it with such ease, though. I mean, you were doing it with such ease. It was just amazing because it was just a natural.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so I felt like, you know, wow, this is quite fascinating, and the way you present it and everything else. Well,
it's fun. You know, I enjoyed it.
We have come close to the end of the show, and like everyone else, and since you've been with us before, I've always asked for a recipe for living. Do you have any recipes for living this morning that you would like to share with us?
Don't blame, don't judge.
Don't blame, don't judge. I like that. I like that. That's wonderful. I like that very much.
I think it's really important to give people credit for the fact that pretty much always they're trying to do the best they can.
That's correct.
You know, the results may not be great, and you can certainly, you know, you judge the action, but you don't have to judge the person.
That's right. Well, Agra, thank you so much for the wonderful recipes, and thank you for spending this hour with us. And to all our listeners, please join us next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Carice Slaughter. She is a certified financial planner and a financial coach. We will be talking about wealth accumulation and preservations for women. For additional information, please check into johnnytan.com, frommymamaskitchen.com, and frommymamaskitchentalkradio.com. And you can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/FMMKTalkRadio. Thank you again, and have a wonderful week. And Allegra, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me on, Johnny.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.